Hello, welcome to the AI Ireland podcast. I'm your host, Mark Kelly. In today's show, I'm speaking with David Maloney. David Maloney is chief scientist at Eubotica and has worked in the semiconductor industry internationally since qualifying with a BEng from DCU in 1985. Previously, he co-founded Movidius as CTO in 2005, which went on to pioneer low-power embedded vision and neural network processing in edge devices before being acquired by Intel in November 2016. In 2010, he received a PhD from Trinity College for his research on high-performance computer architecture and is active in the field of computer vision and AI. His interests span SoC and embedded processor design, deep learning hardware, computer vision, robotics, and navigation. David, thank you very much for your time today and joining us on the podcast.
Thanks for the invite, Mark. It's a pleasure.
David, would you mind just giving us a little bit more of an overview about your past? I know we gave a kind of bit of a bio there, but it'd be great to get it in your words and talking about your research at PhD from Trinity and then your work at Movidius to Intel and then your journey now to Eubotica.
Yeah, so I guess, my interest in all things electronic and so on was kindled back in 1977. I picked up an article in the Scientific American, which was talked all about what Carver Mead and was doing in JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California, about teaching people how to make integrated circuits. And I thought this was really good. And I was doing physics for the Leaving Cert. So when I qualified from a Leaving Cert, I decided to apply for electronic engineering in DCU. And that kind of set me on the path that's led me to where I am today. And I suppose I'm one of those people who's fortunate enough to get paid well for doing something that I love. So, after qualifying, I went off, worked in Germany and Italy in semiconductor companies, Siemens, which is now Infineon, and ST Microelectronics, which still exists as a publicly quoted company. And, got my first exposure to working with customers in the US and that kind of thing. And then basically came back to Ireland in 1994, having learned a lot, and started to work for what eventually became Parthus Technologies, and is now part of SIVA, and went through the whole IPO and everything. And we did a lot of work there. Actually, some of the work was with the European Space Agency. In fact, one of the projects that we were involved in was on a technology which let's say on the very beginning of kind of wireless LAN technology, using initially direct sequence spread spectrum, which is kind of what's used in Wi-Fi, but we ended up doing Bluetooth because we managed to find about 100K in funding back in 1997, 1998, which allowed us to build up a team there. And the standard for Bluetooth was just getting established. So that kind of led me down the road of, low power communications and so on. And I felt, we went through the IPO in Parthus in 2001. And, I kind of felt, by the end of 2002, I reckoned I'd hit the Peter principle, where I'd become incompetent. And I decided, I saw a job. We were doing layoffs at the time because of the dot-com downturn, and a job offer for a research assistant in Trinity College across my desk. And I thought this sounds intriguing, using FPGAs to increase the speed of, let's say, calculations that engineers would be doing, let's say, for fluid dynamics. So that's kind of jet engines and so on, and buildings. And I thought, wow, that sounds very interesting. I'd like to do that. So I basically jacked in the job and decided to go back and do a PhD as a research assistant. And I guess I always had the idea in the back of my head there that not only wanted to have a PhD, I felt I wasn't really competent doing the kind of job I was doing. Even though I could do it, I always felt I felt the lack of the extra academic qualification. But also I like the idea of going back in and doing something, totally from a blank sheet of paper, not following what a customer wants, not following what a standard is telling you to do. So that work in Trinity kind of led me to interact with a lot of people. One of the people that I interacted with was Steve Collins, who was formerly the CTO of Havoc and then of Swerve. And Steve was at the time in Havoc, was working on game physics, but there was no game physics accelerator at the time. So, you know, I thought, low power, you know, of an architecture here that I've come up with as part of the PhD, and I come from a low power background. Let's see if there's an intercept between what the games required today, let's say for AAA console games, and what might be required in a few years' time in a phone. And then between myself and Sean Mitchell, the other co-founder of Movidius, the idea of trying to build a fast processor for doing large-scale fast calculations in mobile platforms with a kind of initial go-to-market of game physics and game AI was chosen, and we kind of, you know, the rest is history. We founded the company in 2005, went through multiple rounds of VC, came very close to death on more than one occasion, running out of money. And eventually, I suppose, we had been keeping the technology very kind of in-house and weren't really telling people about it. I mean, the idea behind Movidius and the Fabric was, it was really built around a fundamental business innovation. Previously, you had to build new sets of masks for manufacturing, which are very expensive. You know, it's like 50 sheets of glass that cost a few million. This is what you use to tool up a wafer fabrication plant to build chips. But we felt, well, with the right architecture, if we define it, then you can do this all in software. So that was the idea, the fundamental business innovation. And that kind of led us to be very flexible in terms of what we could do. So we could run lots and lots of applications. Initially it was game physics and game AI, then it turned into video, then it turned into computer vision, and then it turned into doing deep learning, all using essentially the same chip. So we had been keeping very secret about this until about 2011, when we were running very low on money, and I decided to try and publish at a conference. We published at Hot Chips in Cupertino, just down the road from Apple, and the rest is history. That kind of led a lot of people to beat a path to our door, saying, "Yeah, you have exactly what we're looking for." So we ended up working with Motorola's ATAP division on a computer vision platform, and that eventually turned into Google ATAP Project Tango when Motorola was acquired by Google. Essentially, that set us on a path then for refinancing the company and, you know, a path towards an ultimate acquisition by Intel, mainly for our abilities in terms of being able to do computer vision and embedded AI applications. And, there was some really interesting stuff happened along the along the way there. I mean, one of the things that we were able to do off the back of the refinancing was that one of the VCs basically brought DJI as a customer to us. DJI were looking to take a lot of work that they'd done in the lab in Hong Kong University and turn it into a viable product in terms of collision avoidance for drones. And our chip and software was the way to make that a reality, because previously you would have had to use, you know, GPUs or heavily power consuming FPGAs. So that was a real game changer, that product. We went from, I think, an initial meeting in late December with DJI in our San Mateo office, and we met with all the leadership team of DJI. They made a decision on the day to invest money and to give us pre-orders for parts and very significant amounts of them. That basically set us up for growth. And we did our first training for the DJI engineers in Shenzhen in China on I think it was the 30th of December of I think this was 2014. And basically by Valentine's Day of 2015, they had a drone flying in the air using a board they designed with our chip on it and let's say their software layer built on top of our stack. And that basically was what awoke me to the potential of the Shenzhen ecosystem to really build absolutely groundbreaking products in very short space of time. And I suppose that that led then the cornerstone, because we had real customers and real traction, was a cornerstone for the acquisition by Intel.
David, thank you for that. It's a fascinating journey in terms of how you started this, you got involved in your background and how curious you were to solve problems. So you were at Intel, and most recently you've joined as chief scientist at Ubotica. Can you tell us a little bit about the work that you did at Intel and now the work that you do at Ubotica? And for people that don't know Ubotica, would you mind giving us a little bit of an overview?
Ubotica segues very nicely from Intel, because in fact the roots of Ubotica lie in a European Horizon 2020 project that myself and Oscar Denise Suarez, who's a professor in the University of Castilla-La Mancha in a place called Ciudad Real, about 45 minutes by high-speed train south of Madrid, wrote in back in, I think, 2014 at this stage, or 2013 possibly. And this was for based on the Myriad 2 processor that had gone into the DJI Phantom 4, was to build a kind of a wearable camera. Because a lot of the time your actual camera on your smartphone is in your pocket. You've got lots of capabilities there, but it's having a view of the world is the issue. So we wanted to have a camera that could be associated with your phone that was very low power, but that could kind of do all sorts of useful things for you. And it could be on your lapel, on your belt, or some other place, and provide you with a lot of contextual awareness. I mean, use cases were like something like, well, you know, you're on LinkedIn, you go to a conference, and you see somebody, they're waving across you, you know, across at you from the other side of the table, and you go over to say, go over to talk to them, and you're trying to remember, where the hell do I know that person from? And you can imagine there, your little wearable camera picks up the person, does a face search on LinkedIn, and basically pops up their profile. Your phone buzzes, and before you get there, you check the message that's just come up, and then you sound like the smartest person in the room because you can remember exactly where you left off. So those were the kind of use cases we were talking about. And, the project was very successful. I think we were the highest rated project proposal, and it was rated the best project in the 3-year project lifecycle. It was rated the best project in the EU Horizon 2020 ICT program that year. And I guess, Intel were, very interested in Movidius when they acquired the company, but they weren't so interested in kind of the legacy projects and so on. So Aubrey, who had worked with in my team in Movidius, was at a kind of a loose end, as was a former colleague Fintan Buckley. And I said to you guys, I mean, this project is open source and so on. Why don't you have a look and see whether something can be made of it? Because it'd be real pity. There's a whole team of engineers and a design and everything else that's been spooled up in Spain. And the guys basically had a look at it, and they said, "Yeah, this looks like it's worth going with." So that's the origin, the genesis of Ubotica lies initially in that project. And I suppose because I was in Intel, and in fact, even Noel Murphy who headed up the engineering department in Movidius once we were acquired in Leakslip, basically was very supportive. We got the guys access to tools and so on, and they went off and started doing work on the Myriad platform. And in fact, there was, Intel was routing some business to them where it was interesting work, but it wasn't, let's say, a large enough scale project to warrant Intel corporate looking at it. So Ubotica were a design partner there. And one of the projects, actually, I visited probably 4 years ago now. I visited ESTEC, which is the systems kind of electronics division of the European Space Agency in Noordwijk in the Netherlands. And I, you know, at the invitation of Tony MacDonald, who's you know, outstanding person in EI, who's basically handled the European Space Agency activities for the past, you know, 25 years. So I kind of owed Tony, you know, multiple favors, and I said, I'll go along. So I worked in Italy, so I'm an Italian speaker. And the guy that I met when I went to Italy was a guy called Giorgio Magistrati. And of course, we lapsed into Italian. I was trying to get some practice in. So we were talking about our chip and so on. And it turned out that the processor that we'd used as the main processor in Myriad was our supervisory processor in Myriad was a thing called the Leon 4, which was designed by the European Space Agency and was then released as kind of open source. So that was what we were using. So that was kind of an initial point for discussion. And that between that and the Italian, we started brewing up some ideas. And Giorgio's people in the team is a guy called Gianluca Furano, a very, very smart guy from Rome, where I lived for a number of years myself in Italy. And we basically thought, oh gosh, it sounds like there's really an opportunity here to replace, you know, the 20-year-old electronics that's often being used in these space programs with something newer. And we cooked up this idea for a project anyway, and EI decided to fund it. And that turned into a satellite which flew in September of last year, and it was the world's first native AI-enabled satellite. And that what that satellite is doing, it's taking hyperspectral imagery. So hyperspectral, for your listeners, is rather than just, you know, representing images as red, green, and blue pixels, you have many, many different wavelengths. So you chunk up, you know, all of the spectrum between red and blue into, you know, maybe 50 or 100 spectral bands. That gives you a bit like what a mass spectrometer does for you in terms of chemistry. It allows you to kind of break up the light into different bands and, you know, let's say look at things more closely in terms of, you know, crops growing in the fields or oil slicks or phytoplankton or, you know, how or fire or all sorts of other applications. So having the processing using Myriad 2 in the satellite on the edge has a big advantage, and that's basically the amount of infrastructure that you require to support satellites in orbit is quite high, and it's quite expensive. And processing at the edge allows you to get more out of that infrastructure. So it's a bit like DSL for you know, when DSL came out to replace, you know, it exploited the existing copper communications channel, but allowed you to stuff more bits down it. So effectively, processing at the edge allows you to do that, and that is kind of the main claim to fame at the moment of Ubotic. It's the kind of highest profile project that we have is this FISAT-1, which is currently still in orbit around the Earth.
It's great. It's a great project. And to hear about those applications, like you mentioned, such as the oil slick, is well, you know, there's so many different applications that can help, which is fantastic. And there are
lots of timely, you know, for timely applications, processing at the edge is really compelling, because it can often take hours to get, you know, data down to the earth, process it, and produce a result. If let's say you're trying to detect a forest fire, you can go down from 3 hours maybe in terms of detecting a fire down to 10 minutes. That's the difference between calling out somebody with a fire extinguisher and calling out a fleet of Canadairs to water bomb a hillside. Similarly, you can detect, you know, ships in the ocean. You can detect what type of ship it is, where it is, and you can direct that to fisheries protection, emergency services, weapons, or people smuggling, etc.
Yeah, when you say it like that, you can see the benefits. Tell us about how challenging these problems are to work on and why people don't necessarily gravitate towards them.
Well, I wouldn't say about not gravitate towards them. They're very challenging. The big challenge in space is that, you know, you think space is very cold, But the problem is there's no air in space. So if you generate heat, you can't really get rid of it. So that's the big attraction of the Myriad platform in space, is it dissipates very little heat. It's about a watt or two. You know, if you take other solutions, it could be 10 watts. Yeah, and certainly you couldn't put a desktop GPU up into orbit. So doing deep learning on a very miserly power budget is really compelling up there, because that everything in the satellite is kind of related. The weight, the mass is number one. You know, every kilo that you launch to geostationary orbit costs about $10,000. So, you know, if you have to launch a big cooling system, that's eating into the budget for your satellite. You need bigger batteries, you need bigger solar panels, and it's all kind of circular. So, you know, having a very low mass, low volume, low power inference platform in orbit means that you can put AI where you could never put AI before. And in fact, there still is nothing really on the market that can rival Myriad in terms of being able to do that compute in that kind of power area volume envelope. The big challenge in space is showing that the stuff works before it leaves the Earth, because the last thing you want to do is spend, you know, maybe a couple of million on a mission to launch a satellite and then find out the damn thing doesn't work because the radiation that's blocked out by our atmosphere is destroying the circuit. So one of the first things that we had to do in conjunction with the people in ESTEC was to get space in the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, or just outside Geneva in Switzerland. And Large Hadron Collider, if your listeners are aware or maybe not aware, is the world's largest scientific instrument. It costs 13.8 billion euro to build. And we were able to send our team in there for 37 hours, about 2 years ago now, to actually shoot, lead ions at the chip at close to the speed of light, to basically measure what the effect of ionizing radiation in orbit was going to be like. And the chip, thankfully, passed with flying colors. Little did we know that there were some features in the memory that we had in the chip that actually did error correction on bits that were flipped because of, you know, getting hit by a charged particle or getting hit by a piece of ionizing radiation. And this allowed the chip to basically correct errors and function, I would say, much better than expected in that context. We went on through other iterations of doing radiation testing in a facility in Darmstadt, again, to prove that the chip worked. So once all of that had been done, then we got the green light to launch. So, you know, having space heritage is, you know, having, you know, what's called COTS technology, so custom or off-the-shelf technology. So you can take commercial off-the-shelf technology that you can just take from a smartphone or something like that and fly it in space is a great idea, very appealing from the cost perspective and the development lifetime perspective. But having space proven is the key thing. So we went through, you know, two rounds of on the ground testing before flying into space. And I think that's really that kind of discipline is different from any area that I've worked in what's been a pretty long career to date.
David, you must be pinching yourself. Take it back to 1977 when you're reading that article.
Absolutely. I mean, and in fact, you know, I was, as a child, I was born in 1962. So, I mean, I can remember things like the moon landing and moon rovers and so on. I mean, we all thought at that stage, you know, when we were in primary school, that we'd all be going to the moon and so on by the time we got to being adults. And of course, it never happened. The interesting thing is now that things have all come full circle. So, you know, we had the first round of the space age was very much driven by the Cold War. And I think now the next round, which is in process, if you look at SpaceX Starlink, they're talking about, you know, they have FCC filings which show they're going to launch, 30,000 plus satellites into orbit. I mean, this is, you know, more stuff than has ever been launched in history. Amazon have a project called Project Kuiper, which again is going to provide satellite broadband competing with Starlink. And this is very similar. You have massive investment in lunar exploration technology. People are talking about going mining water for hydrogen and oxygen for rocket fuel, and fusing regolith and building all sorts of stuff. Even potentially putting fusion reactors on the moon and so on as well. So because of the availability of effectively stuff that hydrogen isotopes that are very rare on Earth in large supply there. So there's it looks like there's going to be another race now for space, and where the moon is effectively the next Antarctica. And I to be honest, I thought this was never going to happen. It's been a real surprise what's happened. A lot of it has come from the personal vision and drive of people like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos. I mean, Jeff Bezos is basically liquidating $1 billion per year of his Amazon stock and pumping it into Blue Origin, his space company. So what's different here is that you have a very strong commercial impetus behind space, but still you have the land, the kind of political land grab on the moon. And we've seen the Indians and UAE and the Chinese and the Americans all go to the moon in the space of a month or two, and similar stuff. Sorry, not the moon, Mars, and similar stuff happening on the moon. So this is a really, really hot area. I mean, I was surprised. I was reading the other day, I think, Industry 4.0, which is the idea of putting cameras and AI into factories and so on, is about an $80 billion market today, whereas space, actually, you don't hear so much about it, but it's actually a $400 billion market today, and expected to grow to $1 trillion by the end of the decade. So this is a really big deal, and then the kind of second space race is definitely very much here.
It is truly fascinating, the time we're living in, and for so long nothing was happening, or felt like nothing was happening as well. Tell me a little bit about some of the applications of AI that are exciting you across, I suppose, just general applications that are impacting society that people can start to feel optimistic about, because there's so much hype around there and you always have to be careful it's not clickbait. But day to day, you're seeing different applications that will give you energy.
Yeah, I mean, right now, obviously, people are using AI, whether they're aware of it or not. I mean, all of Google's products, from search through to Google Photos. I don't know. I mean, I got a video back today synthesized by Google for my Google Photos on hugs. So it had basically, the classifier had been, they've trained a classifier to pick out people hugging each other and send, and also, images that fit nicely together, and they're able to compose automatically a nice video that you can share with your family and friends. And this stuff is basically, the genie is truly out of the bottle. I mean, all our kids are using things like Alexa and so on to ask questions, and get Alexa to tell them jokes and so on. It's that's the kind of the day to day usage. I mean, there's some really interesting stuff going on. There's a company called Provisio down in Limerick. They have also a base up in Belfast, and they're focusing on trying to revolutionize safety for pedestrians by installing new technology in motor vehicles. So you hear a lot about autonomous vehicles, but the spin that Provisio are taking is trying to recognize people and potential objects that you could collide with, including other cars, at a long distance away, so they can recognize stuff like 500-600 meters away, and that way you can basically enhance the safety of driving for people driving HGVs and or cars and all of the people using that road network with them. So there are definitely technologies out there, and obviously time is of the essence if you're traveling at high velocity, let's say 200 kilometers an hour in an autobahn in Germany, being able, you know, 600 meters is massive compared to what the incumbents might be, let's say 50 meter range for a vision based system. And the interesting thing about Provisio is they're using radar, so they've some really nice radar technology developed in ESID, which is a university research center from Queen's University in Belfast. A really super team there, and Barry Lund, the CEO, and the other people involved are really, really capable. And I think you're going to see some really interesting applications from them that are, you know, going to improve people's, you know, not only quality of life, but, you know, life expectancy. There are huge numbers of people killed every or permanently disabled by car accidents every year. So that's the kind of thing that excites me.
David, thank you very much for your time today. You provided a wealth of information. I could spend the next 90 minutes, if not longer, speaking to you and sharing more about your background, your history, and some of the work that you're doing at Ubotica and the type of problems that you're solving by applying AI as well. It's really a fascinating area that you're in day to day. And thank you very much for sharing the examples of Provisio and some of the work that's happening in Queen's University. But you've been listening to the AI Ireland podcast. I'm your host, Mark Kelly, and we've been speaking to David Manoni, Chief Scientist at Ubotica. David, thanks again for your time today.
Thanks again, Mark. Bye-bye.
That's all for the episode on AI Ireland podcast. I hope you really enjoyed it. Finally, I'd like to let you know about the AI Awards, which will take place this November. We're now looking for applications from academia and industry professionals to apply. Set up in 2018, the AI Awards is a not-for-profit business, community-led initiative, which is set up to celebrate the best in AI and data science in Ireland. We see this as a fantastic opportunity to showcase your work and skills to the AI community on the island of Ireland and help raise the profile of Ireland as a destination for AI investment. The awards provide applications from around Ireland with a platform to showcase themselves to the AI community in Ireland and the world. Winning an award brings industry-wide recognition, raises your company profile, and increases awareness of your brand and product. Applications take only a couple of minutes. To find out more about the current awards, please check out www.aiawards.ie. Thanks for listening, and I'll catch you again next week. Apply today at www.aiawards.ie. See you soon. Take care. Bye.